This is Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Homeowners across Wisconsin are filing claims with their insurance companies after a severe storm swept through the state earlier this month, leaving damage from wind and hail.
But what happens if a valid damage claim is denied?
In 2023, insurance companies denied more than 37% of claims. That's according to data from the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. There are hundreds of lawsuits around the country alleging that some of these claims were wrongfully denied.
And this week, reporting from NPR highlighted climbing rates of insurance non-renewal for homeowners around the country. In at least one Wisconsin county, nearly 1.5 times as many homeowners were dropped by their insurers in 2023 compared to 5 years earlier.
Later, we'll hear from an insurance researcher about what is driving these non-renewal trends.
First, we'll hear from Ryan Graff, attorney at MGW Law in Manitowoc, where he specializes in insurance coverage disputes and property damage claims. Ryan, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You work on these damage claims. What have you been hearing from clients or potential clients as Wisconsin experienced the severe weather, that hail, for example, and flooding we had just over the last couple of weeks?
Well, the first thing, obviously, is fear and concern on the event itself. And then, as you guys indicated, there's this national trend of insurance companies, unfortunately, covering less and covering less claims and covering less damage. So there's fear among the people of just making a claim.
What is the first step? Somebody has that hail damage on their roof, say. What is the first step? What do they need to do to get the ball rolling before we find out if the insurance company is going to cover that claim or not?
Of course, hail is an interesting thing because unlike fire and water, you could have hail damage on your roof. And I've never personally been on my roof. I think most people have not been on their roof. So typically it's a third party that identifies that hail damage. Make sure it's a third party that you trust. A local contractor would be nice or somebody from the state of Wisconsin. Document everything. The insurance company is going to be documenting everything on their side with what's called claim notes. Every phone call, every activity. You need to do the same. So I would say put everything in writing with your insurance company. If they are going to deny you either partially or fully, you are entitled to an explanation of why they are denying you in writing. You need to get that in writing. And if you feel like you have a legitimate claim and it's being denied, you need to seek out resources, whether that's a public adjuster or somebody like me, an attorney.
That's a lot of people might see that claim denial and think, oh, no, that's going to cost me a lot of money. But that's the end of the process. And as you were just suggesting, it doesn't have to be the end of the process.
It's not the end of the process. Again, my background is I'm 20 years in the insurance business, 15 years as an insurance defense lawyer, 5 as a lawyer suing insurance companies because of the need. So, no, that's not the end of the road. Unfortunately, in today's world, you need a team of professionals sometimes to make an insurance claim. The insurance company has their team of professionals, and there are resources for Wisconsin residents, again, public adjusters or attorneys, as a resource on your end.
When the insurance company gets that call, hey, I have hail damage, flood damage, whatever, what are they required to do by their policies and by regulators?
By policies and regulators, there is a statute in Wisconsin, an administrative code in Wisconsin. It's called INS 6.11. It's the Wisconsin Fair Claims Practices Act. Now with AI and everything like that, you can easily find it. Those are kind of the rules of the road for insurance companies. It's a you will do this or you shall not do this. They have to give you a copy of your policy. They have to respond timely, which the administrative code says is either 10 days or 30 days, which means they can't drag the process out incredibly long. So that's kind of the roadmap. The Wisconsin Insurance Commissioner also has kind of rules of the road for insurance companies that I think it's important for policyholders to understand because individuals, policyholders have a lot more rights than they understand. Everybody kind of jokes about the bad experiences they have with insurance companies and they're not getting back to me and they're not covering this. Well, what people find out if they look at the laws is the laws are the exact opposite. They are supposed to, at every corner, kind of tie goes to the runner, tie goes to the insured. And unfortunately, insurance companies don't treat it that way all the time.
And just briefly, we're going to talk about non-renewals in a bit. People might worry, hey, if I file my claim, maybe it's not a huge expense to me. If I file claims, am I going to be non-renewed? Does that raise the chances of a non-renewal? What do you tell
That's
your clients?
Question. Yeah, this is a question I get from every client, especially in the newest atmosphere we find ourselves in, where you are having a lot of non-renewals and people getting dropped. Again, in my experience, 15 representing insurance companies, 5 representing policyholders, I have yet to see a straight line between somebody making a claim and getting dropped. I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but more often than not, frankly, people get dropped because during the inspection of the hail or the water, the insurance company identifies something totally unrelated to the loss that they didn't anticipate or know about before. A great example is asbestos roofing, right? So if you make a hail claim and they figure out and find out for the first time, oh, you have asbestos roofing, we don't want to insure that, you may get dropped because of that. But I have yet in my 20 years to see a direct line between claims and getting dropped by your insurance company.
Ryan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's attorney Ryan Graff from MGW Law in Manitowoc. Now for a look at what's driving up homeowners insurance premiums and what happens when insurance companies drop their customers, we have Benjamin Collier with us, Associate Professor of Risk and Insurance at the Wisconsin School of Business at UW-Madison. Ben, thanks for joining us in the studio.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
You have a recent report on insurance-related issues and some recommendations. Let's start with our premiums. They seem to be going up a fair amount. What's driving that?
Premiums have gone up substantially since around 2017. I think that the numbers are 28% increase on average across the U.S. after adjusting for inflation. So these are big changes, and they're even higher in disaster-prone areas. Part of this drive is the increasing cost to rebuild homes, inflation-related pressures. But another part of this is that it's become more costly for insurers to manage these really big catastrophes.
Disaster-prone area, that definition may be changing, right? I mean, a hurricane-related storms going 200 miles inland and causing flooding in North Carolina. Yeah. What is a disaster-prone area?
It's a really broad term that is certainly referring to concerns about hurricane risks in parts of the South and East, wildfire risks, not only in California, but in many other places, and increasingly severe storms that include hail damage and flooding and thunderstorm effects and so on.
Okay, paying more, but maybe fewer payouts or more claims likely to be rejected. What are you seeing there?
So one of the challenges has been that local insurance companies can't manage the really big catastrophes on their own. These events can cost billions of dollars. Think about a major hurricane, a major wildfire, tens of billions of dollars. Recent estimates about the storm that hit us in the last couple of weeks are something like $1 billion across the Midwest for that specific event. And so the way a local insurance company will manage the risk that its policyholders will be affected by a big event like that is buying insurance itself. This is called reinsurance, insurance for insurance companies. And so this creates this connection between local homeowners and this global financial infrastructure where we had these really big firms that try to diversify risk across the world. Since 2017, they've experienced a lot of payments related to severe disasters, Hurricane Harvey, Hurricane Irma, the big wildfires in California, and that depletes the capital available to those firms to cover these risks. And so they start to pull back, charge higher rates, and that ends up affecting your homeowner's insurer on what they're able to charge because they're passing this risk off onto these global firms.
And then there's this non-renewal. Insurance companies effectively firing their customers. Is just another big cost-cutting measure?
This is a part of that those higher risk areas in particular are ones where it's costly for the insurer to find reinsurance. And so if those costs go up, insurers may say this doesn't work anymore, even for a policyholder I might have been insuring for a long time. Sometimes there's pressure at the state level to minimize rate increases, and insurers respond to that in some cases by pulling back too. And so especially higher risk homes are prone to experience this non-renewals.
Now you and some of your colleagues made a recommendation on that reinsurance issue, looking for a federal reinsurance option. What are you looking for there?
So this global infrastructure, this reinsurance infrastructure, it's helped insurance markets offer coverage to disaster-prone homes, but that coverage is costly and the prices can vary over time. And like we were just discussing, that's part of the story in the recent past, that big events like Hurricane Harvey end up driving prices up all over the country and the world even. And so there's this high volatile price, and that's really disruptive for a homeowner who's trying to manage monthly bills, and suddenly their insurance premiums may go up by 25%, as we were discussing. And so there's an alternative potentially here where the federal government is taking on more of the the risk that, that an entity would have, that we would need to pay billions of dollars in insurance claims in a given year. And so the proposal is describing that potential where this federal entity would still want to price the risk that it's taking on to try to create a sustainable program that encourages adapting to risk, but also that it might be able to lower and stabilize those reinsurance costs that have added so much volatility to what homeowners are paying.
You phrase things in the report in an interesting way. If I insure cars, well, there's not going to be a storm of car crashes. If I insure houses, there could very well be a storm of hail or hurricanes that suddenly have this massive jump in my costs.
Yeah, the real big challenge here is that we may have billions of dollars of claims to pay at one time, mm-hmm. and that's a complicated prospect for insurers to manage on their own, and that's specific to catastrophe-type risks like major storms.
And speaking of those storms, climate change. I don't want to get through this conversation without mentioning that. Is that part of what's changing the equation here for insurers and reinsurers?
The risks for individual homes have gone up, and that's part of the rising cost, but especially the volatility that we've seen recently seems to be driven by insurers and reinsurers concerned about the really big disasters, the mega disasters that take billions of dollars to in claims payments at once.
Briefly, do you see a hunger out there to solve this problem? You mentioned before we talked that your paper got a bigger reception than academic papers often do from Brookings. Are people paying attention to this issue?
I think that there is a lot of interest in it, and there's been some proposals from sort of across party lines on ways to try to help alleviate some of this volatility. You know, I think there's some legitimate concern that we want to make sure that we're pricing risk accurately, that we're not creating strange incentives for people to live in disaster-prone areas or delay improving their home. And so that's led to a really rich discussion.
Ben, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Benjamin Collier, Associate Professor of Risk and Insurance in the Wisconsin School of Business at UW-Madison. Earlier, we heard from Ryan Graff, an attorney at MGW Law in Manitowoc. He specializes in insurance coverage disputes and property damage claims. Been talking about the rising cost of homeowners insurance, the rising rates of non-renewal, and why some insurance companies are being sued over denied claims.
Coming up, the State Justice Department has a new canine working for its Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force. Find out how these dogs are trained and their role on the job.
They can search for cameras anywhere, inside, outside, things that have been buried. They really have been key in a lot of different investigations.
That's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. The Wisconsin Department of Justice has a new canine working for the Wisconsin Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force.
The 2.5-year-old yellow lab named Granger won't be sniffing for drugs, bombs, or people.
He's a specially trained electronic storage detection, or ESD, canine who can track scents given off by things like flash drives, SD cards, and other computer storage devices. Those can contain vital evidence in cases of child exploitation.
He is one of two ESD canines in the department. Agencies across the state are seeing an increasing number of tips and arrests for these crimes.
We're learning more about how these dogs are trained and how they're helping the state investigate internet crimes against children. Alex Bull is a special agent with the DOJ who's the handler for their other electronic storage detection canine, Moose. And Tammy Lapinka is a senior special agent in charge of the ESD canine program. She was formerly the handler for canine Kozak, who passed away last year. Tammy, thanks for joining us.
Hi, how are you?
Good. And Alex, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Alex, can you introduce us to your electronic storage device canine, Moose? Tell us a little bit about Moose as a dog before you get to his job.
Yeah, Moose is just turned four. He's a four-year-old black lab. He essentially was received from Jordan Detection down in Indianapolis back about almost 3 years ago for DOJ, and we've been working ever since.
And Tammy, can you tell us a little bit about how canines like Granger and Moose are helping the Wisconsin Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force?
Yes, they are a great asset. They're helping us in searching for items of evidentiary value in child exploitation investigations. So as you can imagine, we may search a whole house looking for electronic storage devices, and you could miss something. Something as small as a micro SD card can hold a lot of different files of contraband. So the ESD canines help us go through that residence or car or outdoor search and locate those items so that we make sure we don't miss anything.
Alex, take us into a situation. I'm sure you can't give case-specific things, but you're using moose in an investigation. What would that look like if I were watching you lead moose into action?
So typically, Moose and I get called, and since we're a state agency, we get called literally as far north as you can think and as far south as the state line goes, obviously. And we are constantly going throughout the state. And I'll typically get a request either via TAMI or through the detective itself asking for us to kind of help out with their investigation. Usually they've already obtained a search warrant and have done a lot of the case investigation themselves and are kind of just reaching out to us kind of to marry up with them to kind of just really kind of help out towards the end of the investigation. And the people that we are going after know that the devices that they are hiding, stuff that they shouldn't be hiding, they will oftentimes place it in places that you and I would not be able to see. But Moose can go in and he has an exceptional nose and can smell the specific odor that they are trained to for even the smallest devices that are hidden by our bad guys.
And Tammy, how important are these electronic storage devices that Moose and Granger are finding in the investigation of internet crimes against children?
Some of these are key devices. They are holding the contraband that, as Alex said, suspects don't want us to find. So they are the worst, the material things that maybe they manufactured themselves, where they did a camera hidden somewhere to capture these images or videos, things that they really don't want others to find. The dogs can also be utilized to search for hidden cameras. So if you have a report of, say, a school has a hidden camera somewhere and they want to verify that they located all of those devices to make the families in their community feel secure again about that facility, we can run these dogs through that facility to verify that all of those hidden cameras have been located as well.
Alex, I think I have this right. You did some training in Indiana with ESD canines. What does that training look like?
Yeah, so Moose comes to the Jordan Detection, they are trained for, I think, upwards of 6 or 7 months specific to this scent that I can get into later if you like. So they're trained there, and then basically the handlers go down and they kind of get introduced, and they do a pretty extensive training there to kind of get paired up, lack of a better term. And basically, really, the work that is done after the initial training is kind of about a year long, where you really kind of get imprinted with the dog, and so it's an ever changing process, and continual training is absolutely paramount.
And Alex, you just mentioned there's a particular smell that these dogs are looking for. I wouldn't have thought that there's a smell to electronic storage devices. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, ironically, you say that too. Up about 6 years ago, I had no idea that this program even existed. And so when I started with DOJ, I kind of got introduced to this stuff as well. And so this is kind of still a new program that's kind of getting more and more speed throughout the country. Basically, what these dogs smell is a substance called TPPO, and that is a substance that's sprayed onto any device that can store any type of files, like video files, picture files, stuff like that. And so this substance is sprayed onto these devices. All of these devices have this specific substance, which is the TPPO, and that basically makes it so that the device itself doesn't overheat. And so that's what Moose is trained on. That's what Granger is trained on, and any other ESD dog is trained on that specific smell.
And Tammy, I know dogs are generally interested, right, in the world of smell. How do they get trained and how do they stay on focus on one particular type of smell when they're on the job and not get distracted by, you know, all the other interesting stuff out there?
So that's scent work with canines. You'll hear dogs smelling all sorts of things. They are all trained very similarly. Mm-hmm. So these dogs, like Alex had talked about modestly about how the training continues after they go to that initial training at Jordan Detection, they train at least 2 times a day. So these dogs are food reward dogs, all of the ones that have been through DOJ, and they only eat when they work, which means if Alex or Cade don't have a search warrant that they are taking their canines to that day, they have to set up training 2 to 3 times a day in order to feed these dogs. So being a handler is a lot of work. These canines are training every day on that odor. So once they're in work mode, they know they want food. They're all labs, so they want food. So they're going to work hard to find that odor so that way they can get the food reward that they're looking for.
We're talking to Tammy Lapinka and Alex Bull, special agents with the Wisconsin Department of Justice's Division of Criminal Investigation, talking about how they work with electronic storage device sniffing dogs to help investigate mainly internet crimes against children. Tammy, you trained with the DOJ's first ESD canine, Kozar. It hasn't been that long, but what have you seen when it comes to training and development and figuring out how to make this this partnership with the dog work better and better over time?
So my canine Kozak began in 2018. He was the first canine in the state of Wisconsin. And so our goal starting out is we wanted to expand the program to make this accessible to law enforcement throughout the state within a couple hours at most, instead of the long travel time that I had in the beginning. And so we're working to expand that, getting the dogs more accessible to each law enforcement agency so that way they can be a better tool locating these devices and this key evidence in child exploitation investigations.
Alex, I should ask, what does Moose actually do when he detects, you know, that thumb drive or whatever he finds?
Yeah, so his indication is to sit. So a lot of times, as soon as he sees something, you'll see an indication physiologically. He'll change breathing habits, will change his snorting, you know, his tail wagging. But his indication is just to sit, and he'll make eye contact with me, and that's my signal that he has found something. But he does a lot of things that that most people don't see when he's getting into what we call into odor. And it's fascinating.
Tammy, I wonder, a lot of the focus here is, of course, on child exploitation and internet crimes. Are there other uses where a department could call you up? I can imagine maybe a fraud investigation. You're looking for that thumb drive with the crypto passwords or something like that. Are these dogs available for use in other kinds of investigations?
All of the dogs in the state of Wisconsin have deployed on every case imaginable. So as you could imagine, most crimes now have some sort of technology base. So any crime that has that evidence that you're looking for that has electronic storage, these dogs could be deployed on. That could be a missing person looking for a device outside in the woods that maybe has died, so you can't search for it any other way than the odor on it. They can search for cameras anywhere, inside, outside, things that have been buried. They really have been key in a lot of different investigations, not limited to child exploitation.
And Alex, I understand that Moose helps comfort children as well, not just investigating for these thumb drives and whatnot, but some other parts of the job as well.
Yeah, he's an exceptional dog. I wouldn't say that his ability to comfort is the best. I think he's very good at doing that. I was a little worried when we were told that I was going to get a year and a half old lab. I mean, we've all seen the labs that are bouncing off the walls, and Moose is just not that. He's an exceptionally kind dog, and we've been around children that have been obviously in my line of work have been crying. And Moose picks up on that and will go sit next to them or put his head on their lap. So he's aware of what's happening around him and will kind of dial in to provide that support.
Tammy, is there enough of Moose and Granger to go around, or is there more demand for this kind of electronic device sniffing canine in Wisconsin?
There is a huge demand. As I stated, in 2018 is where we got the first canine. We realized that demand pretty quickly. DCI has had now 2 additional canines. We have partnered with many different agencies that are also affiliates within the Wisconsin ICAC Task Force that have ESD canines as well. So there is 10 currently in the state of Wisconsin between DOJ canines and other local agencies that are affiliates to our Wisconsin ICAC Task Force. And we can still use more. So like I said, we are continuing to try and expand the program to make this a tool that's accessible to law enforcement throughout the state.
We'll leave it there. Tammy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Alex, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate your time.
Tammy LaPinca and Alex Bull are special agents with the Wisconsin Department of Justice's Division of Criminal Investigation. They're with us today to share how they use electronic storage device sniffing dogs to help investigate internet crimes against children.
Coming up, college seniors display their sewing and design skills on a fashion runway at UW-Stout, preview their collections and their Midwest sensibility.
When you're from a small town, you kind of draw inspiration from, I think, the everyday that people kind of overlook.
I'm from Door County, Wisconsin, so there's a lot for me to draw inspiration from just with how beautiful it is.
That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Farad. On a runway at UW-Stout in Menominee, graduating seniors are set to display their sewing and design skills in the Stout Annual Fashion Show.
Students design the collections from scratch, highlighting their personal style and creativity.
One thing these up-and-coming designers have in common, they want to represent the Midwest in a fast-paced global fashion industry.
To hear more about these collections from UW-Stout, we have Jenna Pleer and Lily Clement. They're seniors in the Fashion Design and Development Program, and they have collections appearing in Saturday's runway show. Hey, you two.
Hi, thank you for having us.
Hi.
And Ali Khan is here, associate professor and director of the program at UW-Stout. Ali, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Ali, give us a glimpse of the fashion show. What goes into these pieces that are coming down your runway at UW-Stout?
Well, I mean, it's really a full year's, a culmination of a full year's work. I mean, the students, the seniors have been working on this since August, fall semester last year. And this is the final output, and it's extremely important for them. It's part of their portfolio as they go into the industry to showcase what they have to say and contribute to the industry. So it's a lot of work that has gone into it, and it all comes together on Saturday.
A culmination of so much work, so much creativity, and a lot riding on it because these are their portfolios. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, this is their portfolios is really what shows them, represents them to the industry more than themselves. So it's extremely important.
Lily, you found your love of sewing in high school, and your collection for the show is called The Games We Play. Can you tell us about the collection that you've created?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm doing a streetwear collection called The Games We Play. So it's all inspired by social bar games, traditionally. So I have four looks inspired by the games of pool, darts, dice, and cards. And essentially, it's all about human connection and third spaces. So having a social spot besides work at home is kind of where my collection revolves around. So my slogan is after work, but before last call.
So you would wear these pieces when you're playing pool, dice, darts, cards?
Not necessarily.
No.
So
okay.
All of my looks are just taking inspiration with design choices from those games. Oh. So I do have a lot of different types of fabrics. Like I have professional fabrics like suiting, vests, and like dress pants. But then I'm also including a lot of leather, flowy fabrics, and exaggerated silhouettes. So a lot of the garments are a lot more functional and technically designed, while some of them are also just more aesthetically designed. Mm-hmm. And revolving around those games. So not necessarily, but yeah.
And Jenna, your designs are based on the upcycling movement and incorporating, from what I understand, boxing gloves, Converse sneakers. Can you describe your collection on the runway?
Absolutely. So my collection essentially is inspired by the sport of boxing. I've had a lot of people ask me if I do boxing myself. I've only kickboxed once, but I've always been very inspired by the strength that comes behind the sport, and the strength that comes within upcycling garments, I think, as well, which has always been a super big passion of mine. I've always enjoyed taking things that people would normally throw away or get rid of and turning them into something beautiful again.
And I think about how fast fashion, you know, this rapid production of trendy clothes is really harmful to the environment. I'm wondering, do you think about that as you enter this industry?
Absolutely. You know, I think where we are at with fashion right now, there's a big change happening within sustainability. I think people now have a realization of, you know, what happens to our clothes once they're thrown away. But I think there's also a large problem with a lot of companies taking advantage of people's care for the environment and using it as profit instead of actually trying to be sustainable.
Ali, 13 students taking part in this fashion show this year. Can you take us on a little tour of Stout's design studio? What does it look like?
Well, it's quite chaotic at this point.
I bet.
But yeah, we have amazing facilities consisting of the construction lab with all industrial machines, specialist machines, big pattern tables for all the pattern drafting and cutting and making things. And then we have a knitwear studio on the side with flatbed knitting machines if some students want to explore that. A fully equipped computer lab with latest softwares like OptiTex and coming soon Clo as well. So it's very well equipped. And it's if you like to spend time making things, that's where you want to be all day.
I bet you have students who spend long hours in these labs.
Yes, they're always asking to extend the timings of the lab.
Lily, you know, Milan, New York, London, Paris, the fashion capitals of the world, it feels like Wisconsin is a world away from these places. What role do you think that the Midwest's cultures and heritage, you know, have been playing or will play in the global fashion industry?
I think that the Midwest definitely has its perks. You know, we are obviously so surrounded by beautiful Great Lakes and amazing scenery. So there's a lot of benefit from designers drawing inspiration from those places. Like I'm from Door County, Wisconsin. So there's a lot for me to draw inspiration from just with how beautiful it is and where I'm from and including my hometown and my experiences there into my design philosophy is definitely a perk that a lot of people don't have that don't live in the Midwest and aren't familiar with like how we live here.
Hmm. Jenna, how do you sit with that? How do you represent Wisconsin or the Midwest in your designs? And do you think about the, you know, what is coming from these far-flung places?
Yeah, absolutely. So actually, you know, entering into the industry when I was doing interviews and such, I always felt personally, like I might have been at some kind of disadvantage because I'm not from, you know, one of these big cities where they do all this design work. But I found that it makes me as a designer a very humble person. I draw inspiration from, I think, the everyday that people kind of overlook, you know, like the objects I use in upcycling, the things people don't normally see that, you know, when you're from a small town, you kind of take more of a notice of.
Mm. I understand, Jenna, you've also landed a job after graduation at Carter's in Atlanta, their corporate facilities. Can you tell us about this next step?
Yeah, absolutely. So I did an internship with them last summer, and they asked me to come back full time as an assistant designer, which is super exciting to already get my head right into the field and moving to a large city as well, which has, you know, a lot more opportunities for me to discover. It's really quite exciting, but also very nerve-wracking given mm-hmm. that, you know, I'm so used to being from small town Wisconsin and whatnot, and I'm going to miss it.
Mm. Ali, what types of jobs are students who graduate from this program entering, and how competitive is the industry now for job placement?
Well, I think fashion industry is always very competitive, but there's always jobs. I mean, fashion is such a vast universe that you can find your niche within it if you understand what you're about as a designer. And that's something that we try to instill in them through their 4 years. Our focus is on design. So primarily our focus is always to have the students placed in design jobs, whether they're creative design, technical design, pattern drafting, something in the studio. But jobs are not limited to that. A lot of designers, after studying, realize that they are much better as entrepreneurs or marketers or in branding. So there's always jobs related to that. And then there's writing about fashion, PR. So it really is up to the students' interest of what they want to pursue. And we just try to help them go with that.
And Lily, you are still on the hunt. What is your hope after graduation? What's that dream job?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm still interviewing with a few different companies, so I'm looking forward to hearing back. But yeah, I mean, a dream job for me, I have experience with working with leather and handbag design. So I think accessory design is definitely up my alley. Those are more positions that I'm a little bit more keen towards. However, functional design is also a big passion of mine. So designing a garment that's technical and fits the person wearing it and functional for their everyday, like what it's made for.
Well, Jenna and Lily, all the best to you on the runway. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
And Ali, thank you for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having us.
Ali Khan is an associate professor and director of the Fashion Design and Development Program at UW-Stout. Lily Clement is a senior at UW-Stout. Her collection is based on the games we play, with clothing inspired by group games. And Jenna Pleer, also a senior, created a collection made out of upcycled material. Both of their collections will be part of the Stout Annual Fashion Show on Saturday.
Wisconsin Today producers include Rochelle Wilson, Lauren Cox, and Mackenzie Crummy.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.